The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month?
They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
This episode of Harvey Brownstone Interviews is brought to you by the Harvey Brownstone Talk Show Blend Coffee, available at HollywoodBlends.com. Everyone's saying it's the best coffee they've ever tasted. Why not give it a try and see for yourself?
Hello, everyone. I'm Harvey Brownstone, and today's guest is descended from Hollywood royalty. He grew up in the 1960s as close as anyone can to the world of classic television at the height of his parents' careers. His father was the legendary television producer Harry Ackerman, who brought us many classic TV shows, including I Love Lucy, Hazel, Dennis the Menace, The Donna Reed Show, Leave It to Beaver, Bewitched, The Flying Nun, Gidget, and many more shows. And his mother is the popular and beloved Emmy-nominated actress Eleanor Donoghue, who starred in many classic TV shows. She played Betty Anderson, the eldest child, on Father Knows Best. She was Ellie Walker, the pharmacist, on The Andy Griffith Show. She played Felix Unger's girlfriend, Miriam Welby, in The Odd Couple. She was Kate Honeycutt in Days of Our Lives. She played Gladys Peterson in Get a Life. And every fan of Star Trek, the original series, knows her as Nancy Hedford from the season 2 episode entitled Metamorphosis. She also guest starred in many other popular TV shows, including Newhart, Happy Days, Friends, Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, and who can ever forget her as Bridget, the nice sales lady in the department store who helps Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman. Our guest has had a fascinating career, first following in his parents' footsteps as an actor, then in production for TV commercials, music videos featuring iconic stars like Madonna, Aerosmith, Janet Jackson, and Peter Frampton, and then in television production, working on classic shows like Full House and Friends, before leaving show business and finding his true calling in the church and becoming an Episcopal priest in 2007. He's here to discuss his brand new book, which I absolutely loved, entitled Mom, Dad, Me, and Classic TV, Growing Up with Classic Television's Harry Ackerman and Eleanor Donoghue. I'm delighted to welcome Peter K. Ackerman to our show. Peter, thank you so much for being here.
Harvey, thank you for having me. It's great being here.
I want to start by asking you about your mom. I know she recently turned 87. How's she doing?
She is doing great. I visited her a week and a half ago. I'm on the East Coast now and went back home to Southern California. She lives in Palm Desert with my stepdad, and she is doing wonderfully. She is relaxed, happy, healthy. She swims every day and is just embracing this retirement time of her life.
Please give her my very best wishes and tell her she's deeply loved and remembered by her millions of fans.
Yes, I will. Thank you.
Your mother was a child star. Her first movie role was at the age of 7 in Mr. Big, starring Donald O'Connor. When you see your mom on screen as a child in movies like The Unfinished Dance or Three Daring Daughters, what goes through your mind?
You know, it's just such an honor, because who has, in people our age, have the opportunity to see their mother in MGM Technicolor when their mother was 9 years old. And so I get to watch my mom. Yeah, she's playing a character in Three Daring Daughters, for instance, skipping down the street. And to me, it's just fascinating. It's like a home movie on steroids. And so I just love seeing her childhood work.
Your mom starred in the cult classic Girls Town with Mamie Van Doren, who appeared on our show 2 years ago. Did your mom have any stories about making that movie?
Oh yes. In my book, I mention how it was on TV one day, and my friend was pointing to the screen saying, "That's your mother, Peter." But it was looked like my mother, but the lady had blonde hair because she was playing Mimi's sister, so they put her in a blonde wig. And when I arrived home, I said, "Mom, did you ever have blonde hair?" And she must have known it was airing that day. And she says, "Oh my Lord, you saw Girls Town." And yeah, there's some stories around Girls Town in my book about how they paid her a lot to do the movie. They wanted as many names as they could in that movie, and she was a name back then, so it worked out for her.
Your mom played Ellie Walker, the pharmacist on the Andy Griffith Show, and she sang Away in a Manger in a very popular Christmas episode that I just loved. But she left the show before the end of the first season. Why?
Well, a few things kind of morphed. One thing I love, if anybody's ever into studying early television, I suggest they watch the first 3 seasons of the Andy Griffith Show because you can see a show in development. It really doesn't find its way until the third season, where it kind of becomes the iconic Andy Griffith Show we know. So my mother was cast in the first season. She was the only cast member from Father Knows Best to go from one series directly to another. And back in those days, series episode, you filmed 30, 40 episodes. It wasn't the 12 to 22, which has been in my lifetime. So a lot of episodes. And one, she found that she was tired. She never gave herself a break. Two, she had fallen in love with a man who she was going to marry and become my dad, and she wanted to start a family with him. And three, as mentioned, already the show was in development, and suddenly, when this what they thought would be a lesser character of Barney Fife, played by Don Knotts, came on the scene, the producers suddenly saw the chemistry between Andy and Don and began to reduce my mother's character a little bit and lift up Don Knotts's character. And so my mom said, "You know, this is a good time to ask for an exit." And so she did to do what she wanted to do, marry my dad and start a family. I was born a year later, so I'm glad she made that choice.
Oh, so am I. Can you remember what it felt like, Peter, seeing your mom on TV for the first time?
Oh, yes. One of my first memories. And unlike going back as an adult and seeing my mom 9 years old in MGM movies, what was interesting to me is that my mom, it's an early memory sitting on her lap, and there was a rerun of Father Knows Best on TV. And she said, "Look, honey, look, there's mommy, there's mommy." And in came Betty Anderson through a doorway. And I heard Betty's voice, and I realized, oh, I'm sitting on that woman's lap right now. And so at a very early age, I just understood that my mother was on this thing in front of me called television. And so it wasn't bizarre, it just was the way life was, instilled in me in that very early memory.
Now, your father, Harry Ackerman, started out in radio and he worked with Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland, Orson Welles, Clark Gable, Myrna Loy, Edward Arnold, and many more legendary stars. He became vice president of West Coast production for CBS and he oversaw the creative input for Our Miss Brooks, starring Eve Arden, and My Favorite Husband, starring Lucille Ball, which ultimately became I Love Lucy on TV. Can you share some of your dad's memories of working with Lucy?
Well, he loved Lucy, as I think we all do. And he just it was a remarkable time where he was very instrumental as the vice president of West Coast production for CBS, essentially the president on the West Coast, because Bill Paley, the president of CBS, was on the East Coast. And my dad's job was to be the midwife in creating and taking radio shows like My Favorite Husband and helping them develop into TV shows. Now, because of his role with the network, my dad is not credited But he was heavily involved in all the decisions, including the at the time challenging ones about having Lucy's real husband, Desi, play her husband. Again, this is the 1950s. Desi's a person of color. That was odd. And then he was in the conversations with the many others who, in a group contribution, which my dad always said it was, in developing the three camera technique, because Lucy needed to have all the filming done at once so that she could ride the laughs of the studio audience and draw out the comedy then. And so my dad was involved in the conversation on creating what became the three camera technique. And he loved the experience.
Well, as you know, Peter, Desi Arnaz wrote a memoir in which he claimed sole responsibility for inventing the three camera technique of filming TV shows. But as you've mentioned, your father said it was a group decision. How did Harry Ackerman feel about Desi Arnaz taking all the credit for that? And did it affect their friendship?
Did not affect their friendship. In fact, Desi was a stand-up guy. Desi called my dad. And I believe I answered the phone that day because I did talk to Desi on the phone. And, you know, one day he called and he said, "Oh, is Harry Ackerman there?" And I said, "This is Peter. I'll get him. Who is this?" He says, "It's Desi Arnaz." And so I went to get my dad. We were at a beach house that summer. And Dad said, "Well, tell him I'll be right there. Let me get dried off." And I went in and said, "Mr. Arnaz, my dad will be right there." And he says, "Oh, okay, Peter. So tell me, do you like the horse races?" You know, he just wanted to engage me in conversation. And my memory serves that that was the call, because Dad reported to my mom afterwards where Desi said, "Listen, I'm writing this autobiography. The publishers really want me to have something in there to help sell the autobiography. So I am taking credit within the autobiography of coming up with the three camera technique. And I wanted you to know." Now, I didn't hear about my dad's feelings. Maybe I was too young, but I think it went a long way that Desi called my dad and didn't surprise him with my dad finding out by reading the book.
I don't know how much I believe that the publishers needed something to sell the book. This is a book by Desi Arnaz, the co-star of the greatest sitcom of all time and the ex-husband of the most beloved comedian of all time. So it just seems to me like Desi wanted to take the credit for something that really belonged to a group that included your dad.
Well, and he's not the only one. In fact, everybody who's part of that group has in one way or another over time in interviews or in publications have claimed that they were the one who came up with the idea. And my dad always claimed it was all those people, yes, but we were in conversation together. And my dad had used in some of his other productions two cameras at once. And Al Simon, who is one of the people who says, "I invented the three camera technique," had worked with my dad in using it. I think it was on Truth or Consequences. They used two cameras on the game show format. So it wasn't just one person coming up with the brilliant suggestion. You know, I do believe my dad said it was this group discussion.
And that makes sense to me. There was a 1991 TV movie called Lucy and Desi Before the Laughter, in which your father was played by Matthew Faison. What did you think of that movie and how your father was portrayed?
Well, Matthew did a fine job. It was a hard movie to watch because it came out, even though my dad was involved in just conversations while it was being developed with the producer, he died before it aired. So he never saw it. And in fact, the producers sent us a finished then VHS copy that we, the family, watched the night before his funeral. And it was hard to watch, I think, because of that period of time we were in mourning. And the actor, not knowing my dad, did as good of a job as any. He kind of had the look. He played my dad in at least one scene a little bit more like a salesman, like a Hollywood producer salesman, which my dad wasn't. Like, "Hey, Lucy, Desi, let's do this." But it was all good. It was all good. A decent production. And I write a little bit more about it in my book because there was some dissension with something that happened when my dad told the producer something, and that producer shared it with Lucy Arnaz, and she and her husband, Mr. Luckenbill, were not happy with what my dad had shared, and that turned into a bit of a kerfuffle, but that's in my book.
Well, I'm going to mention that you wrote in your book that one of the very few times that you ever saw your father get teary-eyed was when he received a letter from Lucy Arnaz's husband chastising him for telling a TV movie producer about Desi Arnaz's infidelities. Do you think that's why Lucy Arnaz almost never talks about your father when she talks about I Love Lucy?
I think so. I have to assume so. And, you know, what we do in life has consequences. And my dad realized that. What he did, my dad was, I love the description of him by people that I will still meet. One of the first words that comes out is gentleman. My dad was a gentleman. He was a stand-up fella. He was as good as his word. His handshake was as good as a contract. I've met other people, not this producer, who have told me, oh yeah, your dad was once having a conversation with me about X. And he would say, okay, what I'm about to say is just for background. I don't want it repeated. And the person would agree. And my dad would tell something about background just to give them a little fuller sense of the person that they were talking about. It might be an interviewer doing a story about a TV show or some such thing. And my dad wanted to help by giving a little background, but not, you can't tell this story. Well, my dad did that. The story my dad told, which I'm not going to tell here, it's in the book, reflects just as poorly upon my own dad as it would have Desi. But my dad wanted to give this guy a sense of the state of the marriage at the time between Lucy and Desi. And that producer apparently tried to use it as leverage to get Lucy's participation in his project. And so he said, well, Harry Ackerman is telling us X, Y, Z. So it's understandable. You know, shame on that producer. It's understandable her reaction and the letters that went back and forth between my dad and Bill that caused my dad to cry. I saw him cry three times in my life. That was one of them. And yeah, our acts have consequences. And so my dad told a tale out of school. And now Lucy Arnaz diminishes his participation as the way I see it. She does. I don't know that she's doing it vengefully, but even if she was, I understand it. I accept that.
Well, it certainly was no secret that he was a womanizer, and I don't think that has anything to do with your father's contributions to the show, so I don't see the connection. And I really appreciate you saying that your father's reputation in the industry was that he was a true gentleman, a team player. He worked well with others. He treated everyone with the greatest of respect. How important do you think those qualities were in the success of his career?
Well, I think they were very important because that working together with others, one of my favorite quotes that I read in a Lucille Ball biography said something along the lines that Harry Ackerman was the type of the producer who took the opinion of the fellow studio executive or the janitor with the same weight. It wasn't written that way, but that's what it intended. Is my dad listened to people, and I've talked to actors. You said, yeah, I had a problem with something. I went and talked to your dad, and I've done that with other producers. And you know what? Your dad may not have made the changes that I was suggesting, but he heard me. I know he heard me. He listened to me. So my dad was approachable, and his sets, my book is full of times when I was on the set, both as a young person, as a preteen, and then later as an adult when I went to my dad's sets. And they were always like family. They were family, healthy family systems. Everybody got along. Everybody was having fun together, no matter what any crew member did. And the system took care of itself. When somebody came in, I tell a story in the book about an unfriendly makeup artist who was hired as an extra makeup artist for the day. She was being quite rude. My book has more details. And when she left the room briefly, I heard the chief makeup artist say, call the union. We don't want her back tomorrow. And that was part of my dad's system. It was just we were making family shows. I put myself on my dad's pedestal. He was making these family shows, and they were run by a family. It was great.
When you were growing up, Peter, did you actually understand exactly what your father did in his job as executive producer?
Absolutely not. That was the big question I used to get at school. I would say, "Oh, my dad's the executive producer of Bewitched. You can see his name in the animated credits there at the beginning of the show." And they'd say, "What does an executive producer do?" And I said, "He goes to the studio and he walks around the set sometimes and he comes home." That's all I knew. And then I detail in Mom, Dad, Me, and Classic TV this wonderful opportunity I had during an Easter break for me, who was going to Catholic school. And I love going to the sets of my parents' shows. So Dad allowed me to go hang out on the set of the Paul Lynde show. My older brother went Monday. I went Tuesday through Friday. Friday was the day it was filmed in front of a live audience. And I sat in the stands each and every day, Tuesday through Friday, and saw the development of the show through the rehearsal process, everything else. I was around 11, 12 years old, and I had a better sense of what my dad did because I saw him come on the set and ask certain questions and engage the crew members. And then later, when I was an adult, my dad was making a series called The New Gidget, and he had knee surgery and needed me to drive him around for a couple of weeks. So I did. And I got to see my dad in action in casting sessions, in editing sessions, and everything else. And I then got the sense, okay, as executive producer, he had oversight over the whole. And so he would check in with the writers and he would check in with the editors and he would just make sure that everything was working together, really doing that solid work of keeping that system healthy, happy, and producing. That was his job as executive producer.
You mentioned the Paul Lynde show. I can't resist asking you, Peter. There's been so much said and written about what an unhappy guy Paul Lynde was and how miserable he got when he drank. What were your impressions of Paul? You were there a whole week.
I was there a whole week, and gosh, the guy was funny. We know that. We can watch anything, and he could take any line and, with that sort of sneer, chuckle, make it funny. And so it was fun. I watched him work. He was a professional. I've seen lots of actors work on film sets, stage sets, and he was fine. And the only personal interaction I had with him was that first day, that Tuesday, my dad took me around the set to introduce me to people since I was going to be hanging out all day and he wasn't going to be with me, and appropriately took me to the star of the show. And Paul Lynde was sitting in his chair reading a newspaper. And my dad said, "Paul, I'd like you to meet my son, Peter." And I said, "Hello, I'm Peter Ackerman." I stuck out my hand, and Mr. Lynde put down his paper, looked at me, and gave sort of a sneer and said, "Hello." And then flicked his paper and went back to reading. And my dad escorted me to the next person to be introduced to. So that was Paul.
You're lucky he was sober. He would have said something worse if he wasn't.
Perhaps.
Now, of course, I have to ask you about one of my all-time favorite sitcoms, Bewitched. Can you remember any of the episodes you got to watch them filming?
Yes, and I forget the names of the episodes, but one that for some reason it really stays in my head. It was part of their Salem episodes. And some of those Salem episodes had footage that was filmed in Salem, but others were filmed here in California. And this day I went to the set, Bert Convy was there. He was playing Paul Revere on that episode. And he was dressed as Paul Revere. And I think maybe my dad pointed him out to me. And as a kid, I mean, who in history class doesn't know about Paul Revere? So seeing him and I remember Mr. Convy saying hi to my dad and getting a cup of coffee and a donut from the snack table and having a conversation in this Paul Revere outfit. And so then while I was walking around that set, I came across the actor from who I knew from Lost in Space, who was also in the episode, Jonathan Harris, who played Dr. Smith. And I only knew him as his character, "I'm Still a Young Boy." And Mr. Smith was probably just being friendly, but he also, I think, was reading his newspaper and he saw this boy looking at him and he said, "Hello," in a very Dr. Smithian voice, which is probably just his voice. But I heard the character and I went, "Hi," and then bolted away. That's a very memorable time. And I will conclude, not in the detail that's in my book, because I saw some things. I saw some things that the reader will see were portending the end of the series on the set. But before I saw that, for me, uncomfortable interaction between one of the stars of the show and somebody on the set, it was a delightful morning. Dad dropped me off like he always did, gave me his studio chair, Harry Ackerman, executive producer, on the back to sit in. And Dick Sargent and Liz Montgomery invited me to sit between them while they were filming the episode, and or the scene, I should say. And we had a wonderful time. And together we played the Jumble Game, which was a game in the Los Angeles Times that you could play, where you also had to guess a word. And Liz brought me into playing a joke on Dick Sargent by helping him think that I came up with the solution to the word. And it was just a delightful time. So I have a lot of warm memories on the set of Bewitched. More of them are in the book.
Now, as you know, Peter, Bewitched ended not because of poor ratings, but because Elizabeth Montgomery and producer William Asher were getting a divorce and she didn't want him to remain with the show, but your father wouldn't fire him, correct?
Correct. I happened to listen on one side of the phone call on a, I think it was a Sunday morning, might have been a Saturday morning, and heard my dad report what the phone call was about to my mom. And Liz called and said, I have a boyfriend now. My husband and I are separating, getting a divorce, and I don't want him to be the producer director anymore of the show. I want my boyfriend to take that role. And my dad said, I'm not going to do that to Bill. Bill's my partner. And I'm not going to do that. And Liz said, well, then Bewitched is over. And that is what concluded the show, is my dad wouldn't stab his friend in the back and continue the show for one more season.
So if I understand this correctly, Elizabeth Montgomery would have continued doing Bewitched if your father would have fired Bill Asher, but your dad refused, so the show ended. So Peter, looking back, do you think your father ever regretted not firing Bill Asher so he could have kept the show going?
Absolutely not. He and Bill remained friends, even though I think Bill was not in a period of their relationship, not as loyal to my dad as my dad had been to him. But there we go, the gentleman. My dad was a stand-up guy. Bill was the partner. That's how it worked. And there was no wiggle room. Bewitched also only had one more season to go, so they were only talking about one more season. And although I haven't done a deep study of it, just my own viewing of it, as it was getting to that season that they were in, the show was starting to get repetitive in some of its scripts. I think its ratings were starting to go down a bit, and it wasn't a bad time for it to end. Another year wouldn't have helped or hurt in either way. And so I don't think my dad regretted ending it when it did.
Peter, you wrote about watching your father's career winding down, and you blamed it on what you called his unforgivable Hollywood sin of not reinventing himself. What did you mean by that?
One thing I've learned in my adult life, and of course I don't live in my late father's shoes, but we are called in life, and including in what I do, to adapting. If we try to stay as we were, that's a lot of effort and sometimes impossible. And so we have to adapt and learn to adapt. My dad, for years, made these wonderful family programs. He helped to make them both on radio and then in television. And so that was his niche. That was his thing. But when that niche went out of favor, maybe sin is too strong a word, my dad just did not have the ability to adapt. I'm not saying he should have gone to edgier, all in the family type humor, which was what was beginning to sell in those days. But I wonder if there's not something more he could have done to retain some of the flavor of the family shows, but give what the networks and the audiences of the day wanted. Which he just couldn't do. He could only make one kind of show. And so he really had to wait till the merry-go-round came around again. And when the Cosby Show came out in, I think it was the 80s, yes, the early 80s, family shows suddenly became in style again. And then you had Family Matters and Full House, and all these family shows started to get produced. And so my dad was back in favor, and he was able to get on television a syndicated series called The New Gidget. Because his style of show was in again.
Yes, your father executive produced the TV movie Gidget's Summer Reunion and the spin-off TV series The New Gidget, which was his last TV series, and you appeared in those shows as an actor. What was it like working with your dad?
It was fine. He was rarely there when I was filming, and it was great to have that experience. I had prepared in junior college. I was a member of the Los Angeles Valley College, which had in the early 80s a thriving and active theater department. And I loved live theater and loved the fact that I got to learn how to project my voice to the back of the theater back in the days when they didn't have special microphones for everybody to wear. And I found that didn't translate well for television. My first day on the set of Gidget Summer Reunion, I'm standing with Vince Van Patten and Brad Zutat. We were three surfers in the scene together. And the director said to us, "Okay, let's just run through your lines, gentlemen." And so we did our lines, and I delivered my lines like I was on the stage of Carnegie Hall. And he said, "Yeah, pull that down a little bit. Just speak the line." And so somehow I maneuvered through, and I did have, I do share in the book some adventures I had on the Gidget sets as an actor. But it was also the time of my life. I was getting married myself, and I was starting to realize that production, the side of the business that my dad was doing, had more of a draw for me than acting any longer.
Do you think there was a time later in your dad's career when he felt underappreciated and maybe even forgotten?
Yes, and there lies the rub. And I really try to consider this at times, because when people ask me about my dad, you know, what was it like? Was he so proud? Did he pat himself on the back for doing these TV shows? And the answer is he didn't. My dad was, as I heard him described by somebody else, was making a product. He was, again, the stand-up gentleman, was working for a studio and a network, and they said, deliver this show, and my dad delivered the show, and once the show was delivered, it was time for the next product to be delivered, and dad just kept moving forward. He didn't stay anchored in the past. I didn't know he had anything to do with I Love Lucy for the longest time, because he didn't talk about it, not that he wasn't proud of his connection to it, but he wasn't a braggart. He was about, here's what I'm doing now. And then came this time in his life, which we've already talked about, where he couldn't get a job to save his soul. And he was then starting to feel totally forgotten, maybe feeling like he was useless, like he didn't matter. And I think then is when he would have appreciated somebody, anybody coming out and saying, thank you to Harry Ackerman, who really helped me get to where I am today. And I think he started to spiral down emotionally a little bit at that time, just feeling that his whole life had been a waste, that he didn't matter.
Well, I was very surprised to read in your book that neither Elizabeth Montgomery nor Sally Field attended your dad's funeral, even though he was hugely important in their careers. How do you feel about that?
Well, we all make our choices in life. I think Liz's was made because she, except for when they ran into each other at social interactions or at the studio, Liz Montgomery was really close with our family until the breakup of Bewitched. Until when Bewitched ended, she essentially divorced herself from our family, while her ex-husband, Bill Asher, remained friends with our family. And so I think maybe at his funeral time, Liz might have just decided, you know, it would be hypocritical of me to finally show up at his funeral after I distanced myself from him from this part of the latter part of his life. So I get that. I would have liked to have seen her there. Sally kind of had an ebb and flow with, at least with my dad. She talks about it a little bit in her book. It's also just kind of in TV history. When Gidget ended, she talked poorly about the producers, one of which was my dad. And when The Flying Nun ended, she did the same. And so I think for her, when a job was over, my relationship with the people were over. She has never spoken that I know of about my dad's involvement in helping her during Gidget, but my dad was always proud, and I have to believe him because of the stand-up guy he was. He said that on the first day of filming, she was beside herself. You know, here she was, a, a USC cheerleader or a former USC cheerleader who had been seen and been cast in a show and the series. She was playing the title character. The weight of the series was on her. She was feeling it that first day of production, and it was emotionally affecting her. And my dad took her in his office and said, "Listen, you wouldn't be here unless we knew you could do this. So don't worry about it. You've got this. Just go out and be who we hired you to be. There's no other pressure." And she went and made TV Gidget an iconic character. And that opened up the door for many other wonderful things for her. She's such a fine actress. And maybe she doesn't know. Remember that pep talk that my dad gave her. So again, she wasn't at the funeral. I hold no resentment over that.
Your dad was a real pioneer in the age of classic television. He brought us many iconic TV shows. He served as president of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. In 1985, he received a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. And in 1990, he was honored by the Caucus of Writers, Producers, and Directors. But Peter, even with all of that, do you think that he has been appropriately recognized by the industry for the magnitude of the contributions he made?
That's a tough question, because I am an acorn from my dad's tree. And I would say, as my dad might, let the work speak for itself. On the other hand, to your point, I think he contributed a lot to TV, more than the average person knows. I'm hoping one day that someone who has the time, which I don't because I have a full-time vocation, can really do the research. My book is really based on the conversations I had and the events that I was witness to. I didn't do a lot of rolling up my sleeves and digging down to see all that my dad did, but I'm sure there's a wonderful biography out there to be written if someone's willing to take on that task. And yes, I think, you know, it's really a shame the TV Academy, again, there are so many producers, actors, directors over time, so it's easy to get forgotten in Hollywood. It was amazing to me that a decade or so back, there was an event that the Academy was holding that was a salute to classic television. And my mother wasn't invited. And my dad, he was deceased by now, but he wasn't a part of it in any way. And my mother, even as my dad's widow, who was once a president of that same Academy, them not being invited just says, oh, there's probably some work that the TV Academy could do to bolster itself. But again, you know, my feelings aren't hurt by it. It would be great if somebody would lift him up and give him the recognition that he's due. I think the star helped a lot. The star in Hollywood Boulevard really helped, pun intended, cement the fact that he made a difference in Hollywood. And yes, people may walk on the star and look at it and say, who's Harry Ackerman? But if they do a little bit of research, they're going to know that they have seen Harry Ackerman productions in one form or another for many, many years.
Well, I hope it brings you some comfort to know that your book also cements his immortality and your mom's, because this is a most welcome book for those of us who grew up watching these shows and for generations to come who will want to see these classic shows because they are still airing. You should be very proud of yourself that you've done something that your father, I think, would be very, very proud of.
Thank you. I think so too, humbly, and that's why I wrote it. You know, people, when one finally gets a book published, you know, all your friends say, "Oh, are you going to be on the bestseller list? And are you going to make millions?" The answer to both of those is probably no, and that's not why I wrote it. Is what I tell them. I wrote it so I wanted to keep my parents in the conversation. They were such a part of classic television in different ways. And as I've already talked about, the industry is one that keeps moving forward. New people keep coming in. So it's easy for people to become forgotten. And darn it, I don't want my parents forgotten. They did important work that people enjoy still. And so I want to lift them up. And so that's why I wrote the book.
Wow, and you did it beautifully. Now, near the end of your book, you disclosed that you believe your father had an alcohol problem, which you believe you also acquired. How did you get sober?
I got sober in a miraculous way. I did, I'll start talking about my drinking. I drank just like my dad did. I would come home in the evenings. I didn't drink during the day. I didn't hide something in a desktop. I'd come home in the evening and drink heavily, and drink heavily every night. For almost 30 years, I drank heavily almost every night. Through marriage, through the birth of my kids, through getting ordained a priest, I drank heavily every night. And I had an epiphany. I woke up one Tuesday morning in January of 2012, and I had an epiphany. And this conversation went through my head. And the first thought when I woke, again, it's about 3 in the morning, staring at the ceiling. Marie, my wife, is sleeping next to me. And I said, I'm an alcoholic. And my own voice questioned that and said, what does that mean? And I thought back and said, well, it means I'm not going to drink anymore. And my voice challenged me and said, how are you going to do that? And I said, well, I guess I'm going to try to go to one of those meetings that people talk about. And I got out of bed and went to my computer and found where there was a 12-step meeting that morning. Awoke my wife, told her, I think that I'm an alcoholic and I'm going to go to one of these meetings that they talk about for 12-step work. And I did. And my life began changing ever so slowly onto a different path. My dad drank, I won't say heavily every night. My dad drank every night. I did see his personality change in the same ways my personality changed. I go through that in the book. He was never able to say he was an alcoholic, as far as I know. So he may not have been, but I know I am. And so I work at it. And I'm delighted that I'm over 12 years sober as we speak now.
Congratulations, Peter. That's very inspiring. And I hope everyone who's watching this interview who may be struggling with a substance abuse problem will have that same epiphany. Peter, you worked on the music video for Madonna's song Express Yourself, and you described her as disconnected and uncaring. Can you tell us about that?
Perhaps I'm spoiled, but I'm used to working on Harry Ackerman productions where people are all together and approachable. Madonna wasn't as approachable. And I give a few examples in the book. I'll mention one. We were a non-union crew, which means we could be working long days, 20-hour days, with again, maybe a 3-hour turnaround, go home, take a nap, and come back for another 20-hour day. It was brutal. And one day, the director, David Fincher, decided, we needed to do something for this crew that was just getting beat up. It's a marvelous music video, marvelous production on all ways. And so he said, let's get pizzas for the crew. And pizzas were finally delivered. He called a break. The crew went outside to eat pizzas in the outside warm air there at Culver City Studios. And I happened to be doing what a production assistant does when there's nothing else to do, and that's sweep. And I was sweeping the floor, and I was near David Fincher, who was looking at his shot list about what he was going to do next. And Madonna made this march across this now empty set. And she's like, why is nothing going on? And he goes, well, I gave the crew a break. And he goes, I bought them pizzas. And she goes, they're a non-union crew. Why are you letting them eat? And that's not the type of person I was used to working with. And who knows what stresses she was going through. As I grow older, I have to say what I saw and what I assume was the intention may not have been. But even when I was set up during a scene where they were filming her at top of a staircase, but giving her a close up, upper chest and above, I was there to catch her in case she stumbled on the stairs. And when it was done and she was walking down the stairs, I held out my arm only in case she wanted to grasp it to help get her balance on the way down. And she gave me no notice, no thank you for being there to literally catch her if she had fallen, just no acknowledgement. I was invisible. And that's just not the type of person I'm used to working with.
Unfortunately, there are a lot of stories like that. I'm sure you know that. But one of your jobs in television production was working with a very good friend of mine, Tina Sinatra, when she was making the TV miniseries about her father. What was that experience like?
I loved it, and I love Tina. And I was so afraid I was finishing up one job, and the series I was working on, we got the notice that it was canceled, and we were just going to be wrapping up the office. And I quickly had to find a series. And they said, well, the Sinatra production is looking for office production assistants. So I went over there, knowing that Tina was the executive producer, but also knowing that my dad was one of those many people in showbiz history who at one point of his life found disfavor of Frank Sinatra, where Frank would not speak to my dad in public settings. And as my dad told me once, once publicly turned his back on my dad, literally when my dad walked up to him. And so I thought, oh no, is this going to hurt my chances of getting the job? So I had to interview with Tina. And so I said, she looked at my resume and said, Ackerman, Peter Ackerman. She goes, are you one of the Ackermans? And I said, well, if you mean Harry Ackerman and Eleanor Donahue, yes. And I thought, oh, here it goes. The axe is going to fall quickly. And she shared with me, she goes, oh, your dad was so kind to me. I was a struggling actress trying to do it on my own. And he cast me in something in Bewitched. And he was just always helpful and there for me. And I'm like, oh, dad, good on you. Dad didn't let Frank Sinatra's disfavor of him color how he would treat anybody related to Mr. Sinatra. And it got me a job. So it was wonderful. And she's great to work for. I loved it.
That is the Tina that I know. Now, Peter, you worked as a production assistant on a number of TV shows like Full House, The Wayans Brothers, and Friends, but you said you felt unfulfilled in that job. So after your second season on Friends, you quit and ultimately became an Episcopalian priest. That is a radical shift from the world of show business. Tell me about the spiritual journey that led you to this position.
Well, sure. And I'd gone beyond production assistant. So all those shows you mentioned, I was either a writer's assistant on Full House or on The Wayans Brothers. I was the production coordinator. And on Friends seasons 2 and 3, I was the assistant to the line producer. So I started to work my way up beyond the production assistant role in television, which would for many people say, okay, good, I'm making it in this business I chose to be in, and it would feel great. But I wasn't feeling great. Marie and I were married now for a number of years. Our two children were born. I had gone back to the church that I had been born into, the Episcopal Church. I'm a lifelong Episcopalian, was loving my church family, if you will, and wasn't loving show business as much. And that surprised me. And especially because when on Friends, if you think back, season 2, it had exploded. So at the end of season 1, it had gotten its traction. It became a hit. Season 2 was where, you know, are Ross and Rachel going to get together? The show just exploded. I could pick up the phone and call our representative at Nike who helped supply wardrobe and say, hey, I need some running shoes. And the next day, running shoes, t-shirts, socks would be on my desk. I mean, it was a magical time to be on a hit show. And yet, I noticed I was unfulfilled. So I took note of that. And after just one particular day, I realized that maybe I need to step away. I wasn't being fulfilled. And I'm at a time in my life now where I know it's important for me to take baby steps when I see a change coming and not do a big leap. And so this is where I took a baby step. The big leap was, the leap of faith in the beginning, was leaving a hit TV show. So I told Friends I wouldn't be back for season 4. And I took a job, a 9-to-5 job in a property rental office that was housed in the same building that the Friends production office was in. And so I just went into property management for a couple of years. But during that time, my church suddenly had a part-time job available for a youth leader. And people approached me, Peter, we think you'd be good at this. Would you be interested? And I said, yes. And I took it. And I suddenly found myself fulfilled in what I was doing. And then after being the youth leader, the parish administrator job opened up. Peter, would you take that? Because it's kind of what you do in property management. And I said, yes. And suddenly I felt fulfilled in that. And then suddenly people, priests, youth parents were coming to me saying, have you ever thought of the priesthood? I really get this vibe from you when I see you. And I began to consider that. And longer story encapsulated, I went through the process. It is a process in an Episcopal diocese. I was in the Diocese of Los Angeles to go through the discernment to the priesthood to be allowed to go for it by going to seminary, and all the green lights happened. And I did. I went to seminary on the East Coast. My family and I ended up staying there for a number of years. And yeah, I'm ordained and loving what I do.
This may be a weird question, but does your show business experience help you in your work as a priest?
Oh, yeah, in many ways. I inherited, I think, my grandmother's ability to be a storyteller. So being a storyteller when you're doing things like sermons or homilies, that's always helpful. So, and then in the show business, you know, darn it, that LA Valley College experience where I was standing on the stage, learning how to project my voice across the room, learning how to be comfortable when there's a crowd of people in front of you and not being afraid because there's people with eyes on you. All that training helped me to relax into what I do now. I've got great tools for public speaking, and I use them. And, you know, even in when I had the opportunity to minister to people. I remember I was doing a summer program in seminary, and I had to go to a certain wing of a retirement center that housed people with dementia. And guess what? My improvisation skills I learned at LA Valley College were great at interacting with people with dementia, because I could kind of let them lead. And I remember once this lady, it was raining outside, and she thought she was at her home and that her still living husband was coming home, and she was worried about him. And so I was able to minister to her in the actual moment that she was in, not the moment that I saw her in, which was as a resident of a retirement facility. And it was just great. And improv helped me to be able to do that. So yeah, my show business and training and experience all comes into play with what I do.
What a destiny you've had. Okay, Peter, I'm going to do something a bit unusual. I want you to sit back and just listen to some of the special moments you've experienced in your life. Just sit back and listen to this. As a child, you got to throw a football in your driveway with former pro football player Mike Henry. You got to ride in the Goodyear blimp not once, but twice. Growing up, you attended church every Sunday with Raymond Massey, Fred Astaire, Hal Holbrook, Randolph Scott, and Mary Wicks. You visited the sets of TV shows like Batman, Happy Days, The Partridge Family. You got to watch them filming their shows. You even got your picture taken with Batman himself, Adam West. You got to stand on the bridge of the Starship Enterprise on the set of Star Trek. You convinced Elizabeth Montgomery, the legendary Samantha, to wiggle her nose just for you. You made a TV commercial with George Burns. During your time as a production assistant, you got to meet Anthony Perkins, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Burt Lancaster, General Chuck Yeager, Warren Beatty, Cab Calloway, Sid Charisse, Elliot Gould, and many more legendary stars. And Peter, I'm just scratching the surface. Are there times you have to pinch yourself to believe the life you've lived?
What a life, the way you encapsulated there. I say, wow. And you know what? That was just life. It goes back to that early memory on my mom's lap and seeing her walk through the TV screen, going to sets, meeting movie stars, music stars. It's just a part of this life I was born in. And yes, it's sometimes I do have to pinch myself if I have the ability that I just did with your help to take myself out of the bubble that I was born into and look at it from the outside and say, wow, wow. Thank you.
Yep. You are what they call a member of the Lucky Sperm Club.
Yes.
Well, I only have one more question for you. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
It's very important, so pay attention. Okay, here goes. In 1990, your mother invited you to watch her film her classic scene with Julia Roberts in Pretty Woman, and you said no. What were you thinking?
So I think I had a Sunday off. It was a Sunday. They were closing down Rodeo Drive, and as I talk about in my book, I became my mother's favorite son of her four boys to work on scripts with. I would help her with her lines. And she always liked to go to the sets with somebody. And here was an opportunity. Because she didn't like just sitting around. She liked to sit around with somebody she was comfortable with and didn't have to entertain. And so her son was a great choice. But schlepping to Beverly Hills to sit around a place where they're just filming. Gary Marshall, okay, I'd seen Gary, met Gary on the set of The Odd Couple. You know, I like Gary, but okay, you know, what's in it for me? And I kind of maneuvered, who are you acting with in this show? And she said, oh, it's just with the principal. Her name is Julia Roberts. She was just in some movie called Mystic Pizza. Well, I hadn't seen Mystic Pizza, which was the breakout film for Julia Roberts. So I had no idea who this Julia Roberts was. And I said, nah, my mom, some actress, ugh, a day away from home. Nah. I said, mom, no, I'm not going to go to this one. And suddenly Julia Roberts became Julia Roberts. Soon after that, I saw Mystic Pizza and my heart thumped for this gorgeous brunette woman. And it's like, darn it, what a story I could have had by being on the set of Pretty Woman. But instead, I've got a story, kind of the bonus, the booby prize, as we might call it, of a good story by not being on the set of Pretty Woman.
And that was probably one of the best scenes in the whole movie. Well, Peter, it's been such a pleasure meeting you and having this opportunity to discuss your wonderful parents' careers and your life. Thank you for writing the book, and thank you so much for taking the time to appear on our show.
Harvey, thank you for having me on the show. Appreciate it.
Our guest has been Peter K. Ackerman, whose book entitled Mom, Dad, Me, and Classic TV: Growing Up with Classic Television's Harry Ackerman and Eleanor Donoghue is now available on Amazon and wherever books are sold. My name is Harvey Brownstone. Thank you all for watching us. See you next time. Thank you to my producer, Steve Silver, my managers, Rick Marcelli and Robin Bragg Marcelli at the Marcelli Company in Hollywood, my director of programming, Robert Monaghan, my PR directors, Eileen Shapiro and Jimmy Starr, and my entire team at the XPTV One Network in the UK.
Thanks for watching. Be sure to check out all the great interviews on the Harvey Brownstone Interviews YouTube channel. Don't forget to subscribe and ring the bell to be notified when new videos are posted.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.